Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil,
pasó Guendouzi, Pepe,
is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnar Blog. James.
Wow. That is the goodliest morning of all time, I think. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome. I felt like after such a long time with not winning a game and having a goodly morning at last, it deserved something a little more than just a goodly morning. Even our good friend at Simpsons Arsenal did a nice little gif with Itchy and Scratchy sitting on their porch drinking lemonade, wishing each other a goodly morning. I don't know which of us would be Itchy and which would be Scratchy.
No, difficult. Do you have a preference?
Well, I'd rather be the one that wasn't being flayed alive and sent into space and having its head blown up and boiled alive and that kind of stuff. So if
that
I had
does
the choice...
Seem, yeah, and that does seem like my natural casting, I have to be honest. So.
Some people were wondering last night if we won, because we won, that you know, something terrible might have happened to you. I assume you're all right. You sound
fine.
I'm
racking my brains. Most things are fine. I mean, I will say I'm in the process of trying to buy a flat, and yesterday I found out that the building that it's in is moving. So that was a concern.
Hang on one second. The building is moving in the sense that it's being relocated, or it's actually moving from side to side?
It's moving, as in the London clay on which it is built is not as stable as you might wish for. So that does count as troubling news, certainly.
It does.
So maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. I mean, maybe it's just karma finally coming home. Maybe we were just due this. I mean, how long did we wait? 2 months? More than 2 months for a win?
64 days. 64 days between October the 6th and winning yesterday. We beat Bournemouth 1-0 and then we beat West Ham last night. So yes, it has been a long time coming. And I think you're right. We do deserve it. We've been through the mill. We've had some difficult times. And while I don't think we can state with any certainty that this is the end of our difficult fixture list or difficulties within the Premier League, it is just fucking, it's nice to win. It's so nice to win. It's so nice to go to bed and not worry about what you're going to have to write about in the morning or find a way of explaining what's going on. You know, we can get into the nuts and bolts of it, but it was just lovely to win. And before we crack into the match and everything else, can I just say welcome back? Welcome back to the many listeners out there who just felt they could not inflict more Arsenal misery upon themselves during that difficult run. I understand it. It's not easy. It hasn't been easy for us. And this is a podcast in which we are going to discuss an Arsenal win. People are going to be interested again because it's something new and fresh and different and exciting. So to all of you who've put the podcast on hold for a little while, we don't bear any grudges. We understand. But welcome back. We're glad to have you.
Yes, welcome back. You haven't missed much. Mainly me singing Lewis Capaldi. That was about it.
That was as good as it got.
That was as good as it got.
God damn if that doesn't sum up how bad things have been.
But at least, yeah, I mean, wow, it's just a huge relief, palpable relief, I think, from every Arsenal fan at a result that just is long overdue. And I suppose the elation of the Arsenal fans echoed by the elation of the players on the pitch. I mean, great scenes at full time, and I think we all felt that, didn't we?
Absolutely. I thought that was great. And it's so weird, isn't it? Because it's been so tough and so disheartening that when you see the players react in the way they do yesterday, ordinarily you would say, geez, guy, come on, you've just beaten West Ham. That's it. But there was something in the results, the importance of it, the fact that they've broken through whatever this kind of psychological barrier they've had, this really deep rut that we've been in. It's been very difficult for them to find a way out of it. And I do think one of the things I've enjoyed most about Freddie Ljungberg is the fact that he doesn't sugarcoat anything. You know, he says when things are bad, he says when things are good. I mean, they haven't been that good, but he was talking about how difficult it's been for the players. And I know we can say they're professionals, they're paid a lot of money, they should do better, they should perform better, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we take away the human element of it. And I think Freddie was quite strident when he was making that point. So for them to have struggled for so long and then to kind of to finally, you know, open the door into what we hope is a brave new world. You could see the relief as much as anything on their faces and the way that they reacted when the game was over.
Yeah, you could. And you saw it in their celebrations after every goal too. I mean, I just felt there was a bit of a togetherness there, which has been so absent from this Arsenal team, seemingly, in recent weeks. And I really liked as well that Freddie, in his post-match interview, you know, he put all the credit onto the players. This was his first win as Arsenal manager, one he must have been desperate for. He would have hated to have come into this spell and not have had at least a night like this, you know, something really positive for him to take away from the experience. And yet, when he was asked about it afterwards, he said it's all down to the players. And I love that humility. And I think that, you know, he clearly really does believe in this group. Even someone like Nicola Pepe, who he didn't start in his first two games, he was talking about him being an amazing footballer. He's very generous. And as much as he can give very clear and lucid criticism, he also seems determined to imbue the players with some confidence, some happiness, which is what they need right now.
Yeah, I think so. And probably when you've worked with someone like Arsene Wenger, who was very much a guy who accentuated the positives.
Yes.
You know, at the same time, he'd talk about the failings. And I think Freddie has had no choice but to address those because they've been so wide and varied over the last little while. But yeah, this idea of putting it on the players, I think, and giving them all the credit was really notable, because it was in the Sky interview where the guy said to him, well, you know, what about the manager? He's got to take some credit. And he went, no, this is all on the players. I'm just there to guide them a little bit or something, I think is what he said. So, yeah, I love that. And I just love the fact that we've won again. And maybe the bar has been set really low over the last little while, but it feels nice to be able to go into this podcast and talk about some of the positive things.
Yeah, I mean, it's worked, hasn't it? The bar has been set suitably low that we are absolutely delighted with this. And to be honest, I don't think that's the worst thing. I mean, it means we're back to really, really, really enjoying what otherwise might have been a relatively routine win. And yeah, you've got to take the good times when they come. And right now, this is definitely one.
Okay, well, look, let's go back to the start, and let's talk about the team selection. And well, there was an issue in the warm-up because we lost Hector Bellerin with a tight hamstring. I have to say, just some of the criticism that I saw directed at Bellerin.
I saw you tweet about this because I've not really witnessed it. So please tell me what.
Well, just people sort of going, oh, Bellerin, he's too soft. He's too this. You know, he's finished. You know, he's not the same player that he was. And maybe he won't be the same player, you know, after the cruciate ligament injury. But he did it in January, and it takes 9 months to just get back to the fringes of the first team after an injury like that. Mm. And it then takes weeks and months to build your fitness, your sharpness, your power, your pace, all of those things. And there's such a short-term view of how serious that injury can be to players. Like, everyone knows it's serious, but then as soon as he's back, they're expecting him to be at 100% again. I don't really get it. I don't get the short-termism or whatever it is, you know, that you would think there would be some understanding of a player coming back from a really serious injury. We know they get little aches and strains and niggles, and that's one of the really serious side effects and consequences of a big injury is that when you come back, you're overcompensating, or you're trying to build up your muscles again, and you get a hamstring strain or a calf strain or mm-hmm. groin strain or whatever it might be. So it's really understandable. I mean, look at what's happening with Rob Holding. Holding is maybe a month and a half ahead of Bellerin in terms of his recovery from a cruciate ligament injury, and he's struggling for fitness. You know, he's got a little knee problem at the moment, which is probably related to the cruciate thing. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why people are so unaware of how physically difficult it is for a player to come back, and I don't know why he's being criticised. You know, because he picked up a little bit of a hamstring strain, and in a precautionary way, the club have said, don't go out there and play because you could make it worse.
Yeah. And look, I'm sure Hector would have wanted to be out there. Hamstring strains are associated with cruciate recovery. It's something that happens all the time. And I think Arsenal taking a precaution that might mean he's back in a week or 2 weeks rather than 6 or 12 weeks is definitely the right decision. And interesting, I thought, the way Freddie responded to it, because, you know, he had David Luiz there on the bench. It would have been quite easy for him to bring Luiz back into the side, shift Chambers out to the right. But instead, he turned to Maitland-Niles, a guy who hasn't played at right back since that fateful Aston Villa game in which he was sent off. So yeah. it showed, I think, that he was quite committed to his idea, which, you know, involved taking Luiz out and playing with overlapping fullbacks.
Yeah, and look, you could see very early on that Maitland-Niles was nervous, that, you know, he hadn't played for weeks and weeks, and you could see mm-hmm. that maybe his first touch, I think, going back towards his own goal wasn't great, and then there was a pass that went out straight out for a throw, and you could see, okay, he's a bit nervous here, and the team were nervous. The passing was very safety first, wasn't it? But you're right to make that point about Freddie, because it's a big decision to leave out David Luiz, you know, given his experience and his stature, you know, not based on his performances, obviously, because he's been really poor. But he made that decision because he wanted the team to play in a certain way. And I do think that it would be good for somebody to sit down with Ainsley Maitland-Niles and say to him, look, your chances of playing first-team football at Arsenal in midfield are really slim. Your chances of playing in the front three as a winger, where you've said you want to play, are almost non-existent, because we've got a £72 million signing that came to life last night, and we'll obviously discuss Pepe. But what you do have is an opportunity to play pretty regularly at right back. And I know this isn't a position you want to play in, but this is a chance for you at this football club to establish yourself as, you know, either solid, dependable backup for Hector Bellerin, or potentially somebody who could play a lot of games while Hector is recovering from that injury. Yeah. I mean, I don't think the right back spot, because of Bellerin and the question mark over his fitness, et cetera, is set in stone. We know Chambers is not the guy, you know, as hard as he tries. It would be good for someone just to remind him that there's an opportunity there.
I couldn't agree more, and it is his best chance of playing sort of semi-regular football at Arsenal. You know, you can't change. The heart wants what it wants. If he doesn't want to be a right back, then I guess there's only so much we can do. But from a professional perspective, yeah, he should be taking that opportunity really seriously. He's missed a lot of football since he said he didn't want to play right back, that Callum Chambers has picked up in his stead. And I think he might have a bit of regret about that. I thought he got better as the game went on, which is sort of what you would expect in the circumstances. And, you know, if Bellerin is out, he is the most obviously analogous right back. He is the most similar player we have to play in that position. And Bellerin is going to miss games. So it is a chance for him. I hope he knuckles down, and I hope he wants to take it.
Yeah, yeah. So he made that decision. Obviously, he brought in Kieran Tierney as well at left back. Yep. He moved Callum Chambers into the centre of defence alongside Socrates. So that was his decision on how to find the right balance from the difficult options that he had, you know. I think Chambers did well there.
Yeah, I mean, centre-halves is such a trouble for Freddie, and I think the fact he started a different pairing in every game tells you everything you need to know, really. It's almost like if he was the incumbent manager and he was here in the long term, you'd think, well, he's sending a message, isn't he, to the boardroom by saying, what I've got isn't really good enough. Yeah. He may be doing that anyway, to be honest, but I thought Chambers did okay. I mean, I know that he's been really, really pushing for this chance at centre-back, and he got it, and I thought he was pretty steady. I mean, yeah. He played there against Newcastle. We kept a clean sheet. Just the one goal conceded last night. So, which for us is pretty good. I mean, it's been two a game, I think, until then.
Did you notice? Sorry, I was going to ask you. Did you notice before the game, just before kickoff, cameras were on him and he called Socrates over. And he called him over and he was sort of giving him a bit of a talk.
Right.
It was like...
I didn't see that.
He was the guy saying, look... blah, 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 this is what we're going to do. And Socrates was sort of standing there looking mournful and nodding away. But it was like Chambers was the senior guy, if you like, which I thought was quite interesting to see.
Yeah, and I think he must be aware of the problems at centre-half and think, actually, we're not that far from me kind of establishing myself as number one choice in this position because, you know, everybody else is a bit of a mess. So, you know, I think it was a good night for Chambers, and based on the positive result, I think he deserves to be stuck with.
Yeah, I totally agree. The other thing that Freddie did, of course, was to drop Alexandre Lacazette, who scored three goals in his last three games. But I think people would say he hasn't really performed in general anywhere near his best, and he looks like a guy who's not particularly happy with his lot. So the decision, and it's something we spoke about on the podcast, it was what I would have liked to see was Martinelli on the left, Pepe on the right, and Aubameyang up front. Now, it took an hour for it to really pay dividends, but I do think there's also something commendable in the way that Freddie picked that team because he went for an 18-year-old making his first Premier League start, and Pepe, who, as we know, has been really finding it tough for form, for confidence, for belief. You know, he's had problems settling in. He's had problems performing. And I think we even saw that in the 60 minutes before he kind of came to life. You know, there were moments where he looked good. There were moments where he looked really poor. And I think in the 15 minutes leading up to the first goal, I was looking at him going, oh my God, this is not working out, really. I don't know what to think about this, but I can kind of understand why he hasn't been playing, because he looks like a guy absolutely shorn of any confidence. You know, when you look at the guy who did what he did last season for Lille and the way he played with such flair and such verve, this guy looked a million miles from that. But it was still quite a brave decision because, in the interest of balance, he picked two players who, for various reasons, might not have performed.
Yeah, absolutely. But they were two players who seemed to me to be much better suited to the system we wanted to play. And it meant moving Mesut Ozil into a central area. And I thought he had a mixed game, Mesut. But, you know, I think he led the match for passes in the final third. So he was clearly instrumental to everything we did going forward. Pepe, I agree with you that he had good moments and bad moments in the first hour. But what I would say is that in that period where we were really bad, I mean, let's make no bones about it. The first half performance was pretty poor from Arsenal. I did kind of feel like if anything was going to happen, it might be from him, because even though there was a kind of a slightly sort of scattergun roulette element to what he was doing, he did have moments of danger or moments where he could go past a guy or could find a bit of space. And I just had a bit of a hunch that he might come good. I didn't see him coming good quite as spectacularly as he did. I mean, what a fantastic goal he scored. And what a big night it could be for him. I mean, that moment with him and Freddie on the touchline, that felt quite special, actually.
It did, yeah. It really did. We'll come back to his contribution at the other end of the pitch, but I just want to touch on a couple of things. One will be the West Ham goal, but just before the West Ham goal, it's Aaron Cresswell, isn't it? That's his first name. Subjected Pepe to what was a really, really dangerous tackle. If you watch it again, he is off the ground. He jumps in from the side at full pace. I know he gets the ball, but we have to really talk about protecting players from that kind of a tackle. At the very least, for me, that was a yellow card. And the fact that Mike Dean saw it and VAR also looked at it, according to Sky, and decided that a player launching himself off the ground with 2 feet off the ground, I'm not saying he went in two-footed, but, you know, there's a recklessness to that challenge. I can't believe that wasn't even a booking.
No, I agree with you. And I think the ball is what misleads people at times. They see, oh, the ball, you know, he got the ball. But the way in which he flies into it is really, really reckless. It reminds me a bit of, there was a Thierry Henry tackle once upon a time in the right back spot for Arsenal where he
was it on Carragher, was it?
Yeah, maybe. He just absolutely took off and was like mid-air. And it was kind of similar, actually. And I feared for Pepe. He looked to be in a lot of pain and his knee had slightly twisted as he'd gone down. Fortunately, he got up and played on, and he did the best thing a winger can do in that situation, which is that he gave Cresswell a bit of a nightmare, and he ended up getting substituted, didn't he? He was injured and had been booked finally for what should have been a second yellow card.
Yeah, I'm just watching that tackle again.
I mean, that is one of the most extraordinary attempts at a tackle.
It was against Everton,
right.
And it was in the 92nd minute, and he loses the ball going into the Everton area, and I think it's David Weir is the defender. He wins it. The ball's going out to the touchline, and he literally jumps like a long jumper to try and get it. Like, unbelievable. I mean, he was booked for that, and quite how it was just a booking, I'll never know. It was ridiculous. But I think there's something a bit more, maybe a bit more sinister about the Cresswell one. You know, Alan Smith on Sky called it a sturdy challenge, and that kind of does it a disservice, I think. It was a dangerous challenge. And I think there was somebody sent off quite recently for a tackle in which they won the ball, but because of the way they followed through, they caught the opponent. Could have been last weekend or the weekend before. I can't quite remember. I can't remember the teams. But
that's the way it should be. If the challenge is reckless, then it should be punished. The only thing I can say is that Cresswell, like I say, eventually did have to go off injured, and West Ham brought Masuaku on at left back, and we did get a bit of karmic retribution there because he couldn't deal with Pepe at all.
No, but I mean, the fact that Cresswell made another challenge on Pepe, a really bad challenge on Pepe in the second half, not long before he went off. I think he'd actually got injured and just said, fuck it, I'm going to take the guy out because I know I'm coming off here. You know, that should have been a second yellow card. But look, Mike Dean, VAR, fuck those guys. We know how that goes. Moments after that first Pepe challenge, West Ham went ahead. Not the finest moment for our players in a defensive sense. You could look at Aubameyang and the way that he didn't quite clear the ball. You can look at Kolasinac and the fact that his positioning was all over the place. You can look at Xhaka for not being brave enough to stick his head in where it hurts. We spoke last week, didn't we, or earlier this week, about Lauren Koscielny and the kind of challenge that he would make in the box, which often resulted him in taking, you know, massive blows to the head. It's not nice, but that's what defending is about. You've got to be able to, and you've got to be willing to stick your head where it potentially might hurt. Xhaka wasn't willing to do that. And Maitland-Niles, part of me thinks he was trying to get out of the way because he knew Leno might have had it covered, but you've got to do your job as a defender, and that's just block the ball and get in the way. So nobody really covered themselves in any glory there.
No, I would agree. I mean, I think the Xhaka one looks particularly bad, but I think maybe that's because of the context around it. People are probably questioning his commitment anyway, given some of what's gone on. And he didn't sort of put himself on the line there as you might like. But, I mean, the first half more generally was just the most diabolical half, I thought, and two teams who looked really scared, to use Freddie's word from last week. They both looked scared to make mistakes. They were playing it very cagily, and I kind of think West Ham probably couldn't believe their luck that they went ahead. I'm not sure either side especially deserved to be in front at halfway.
No, I mean, I think West Ham's plan was to sit deep in a really low block and to stay organised and to deny a space and then wait for Arsenal to inevitably do something silly with the ball, which would allow them to counter. And that, you know, that whole transition thing comes up again. There were a couple of moments in the first half where I think we were caught out. I think maybe we were a little better, a little more aware, and got back more quickly than we have done in the past. But yeah, two teams really, really low on confidence. Arsenal the pace of the passing was really frustrating, wasn't it, in the first half? You know, rolling the ball from one side to the other and taking the easy option, the safe option, because nobody wants to be the one to give the ball away. And I think it's interesting that when we did start to play a little bit in the second half, it was a willingness to pass the ball between the lines that brought about the turnaround. But that first 15 minutes of the second half was just as bad, if not worse.
I've blacked it out now. See, I've only thinking about that 15 minutes in which we scored the three goals. The rest of the game, I've basically tried to forget.
Okay, well, let's go there then. Let's put that 15 minutes into the bin, along with the first half, where it belongs. And we spark into life in a 9-minute spell in which we score three times. So the first goal, Torreira to Kolasinac, and Martinelli, who had been pretty quiet. His involvement had been minimal, I think. I was wondering before we scored the goal, I was going, why aren't we getting this guy on the ball at least? Why aren't we even trying to let him run at the defenders? And I think it was difficult to work the ball into positions where he could do that because of the way West Ham were organised. But Kolasinac got forward well, a good cross, and there was Martinelli, a goal on his first Premier League start. And you know, there have been few bright spots in this season, but he really is one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And while he had been quiet, I think his biggest contribution to Arsenal was off the ball. We had a tweet, actually. Thomas Javich tweeted us saying, interesting stats about Martinelli. No Arsenal player regained possession of the ball more times. No Arsenal player made more tackles and blocks. He made 20 high-intensity sprints in the game. The second was Fredericks with 11, and then Alba was 10. So nearly double as many high-intensity sprints as any other player.
Right.
He is so intelligent in his movement. And one of the interesting things is obviously we've seen him play predominantly as a centre-forward, but he talks about enjoying it out wide. And seeing that goal, you could kind of understand why, because although he did start on the wing, there were times where he really was playing as a kind of second striker. His movements inside and his movements into the penalty box and getting quite close to Aubameyang were really threatening and really dangerous. And this was a great example where he picks up the cutback from Kolasinac and a really good finish too. I mean, that's a first-time finish, really composed into the far corner. And on his first Premier League start, I think he's the fourth youngest goal scorer for us in Premier League history.
Wow.
I think he might be the youngest to score on his first start in the Premier League. So, yeah, just he really has been a sensational signing. And as much as we've been critical of recruitment in some areas, you know, that's not one you can criticise at all.
No, not one bit. And I think, you know, he justified his selection. Freddie was rewarded for his bravery in picking him, because it is a brave decision to pick an 18-year-old away from home in the Premier League. And yeah, look, it's great to see. So let's talk Pepe. I'm just watching the goal again. It starts at the back, and it's quite interesting. It's, you know, Torreira plays it between the lines to Ozil, who drives in, plays it to Aubameyang and to Pepe. That felt like a huge moment in his Arsenal career, didn't it? Because things have been so tough for him, and you know, he did score those two great free kicks, but didn't really get the confidence bounce or boost that we would have liked, because he was left on the bench mostly after that. We were looking at those goals as, oh, this is the time that he's announced himself. I think what we can say, in the moments that he has caught the eye, they've been really, really good. Like, those two free kicks were amazing. That goal last night was one of those, again, where it looks really simple, but it's not. I think the execution on the finish was just top class. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that there are obviously things for him still to work on, but the quality that he can produce is really out there. It's exceptional.
Yeah, and actually, I know we talk about watching, you know, YouTube clips of him from last season, But I've seen all of his goals for Lille, and not many of them are of the sort of aesthetic quality of the ones we've seen in an Arsenal shirt. In fact, the moments where he has scored for us, it's almost like he's elevated. He's had to step up to an even higher plate. Mm. And yeah, this is a brilliant, brilliant finish. There's on the Arsenalist website, they've got the goal with the French commentary. And as it hits the net, the commentator goes, Pepe, enfin! Finally. And, you know, that's very much how it feels. It's not his first goal in an Arsenal shirt, it's his fourth, but it does have this sense of finally he has arrived. You know, this is a...
I do like those French commentators.
Yeah.
They're fucking good. Like, a lot of the goal clips tend to be from French football, and there's a lot of ooh la la! Yeah. Sort of stuff going on. Hang on, let's play this, will we? Let's see if we can play it here. Oh, yeah, I can see it's from RMC Sports, so let's give this a go. Hang on. Oh, skip the ads, yes, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, hang on.
Arsenal's got guys. Good money, don't worry.
Maintenant, ça fait 6-8. Ça baisse un tout petit peu le taux avec ce but de Martinelli. Mais on l'attend, le buteur gabonais. Peut-être là, ce sera Nicolas Pepe. Enfin dans le jeu, Nicolas Pepe.
I like it.
Yeah, it's a great moment for him. And, I mean, there was no sort of cool celebration. Do you know what I mean? There was no Thierry Henry brushing off the shoulder. He was really delighted with that, and rightly so.
The teammates were delighted for him as well, weren't they? Because you could hear it on the cameras. You could hear a lot of Nico.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. So.
Always have a mic behind the goal in case they celebrate there, definitely. But I just thought the other thing I would say is this goal, like the first goal, actually came after Arsenal just being a little bit more ambitious with their passing between the lines. It was Torreira in the build-up to the first goal, played that really nice pass into Kolasinac. And then on this one, Ozil, he plays a pass that looks straightforward, but it's not really. I mean, he picks Aubameyang out on the other side of the penalty area when he's surrounded by a couple of players, and it just opens up the space for us to find those moments. And so many of our recent goals and recent chances have come from dead balls, from set pieces. To see it clicking in open play is just a huge, huge relief.
Yeah, for sure. And what about Aubameyang in the build-up to the third goal as well?
Mm.
Really, really smart back heel. And the movement then to get into the box. Pepe picks him out with a cross. And yeah, great finish. Great finish because the ball was slightly behind him, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it was. And he finishes really well on the turn, actually. And that's what he does. And, you know, that's why so many people want to see him in the penalty area, because, you know, there's no one really who finishes quite like he does. I mean, Lacazette's missed some big chances without wishing to dig him out in away games in recent weeks. Aubameyang had that one last night and he put it away.
Yeah. So 3-1, and there's 20 minutes to go. And look, I can't say I felt safe. You know, given everything that's happened over the last little while, I did not feel safe. As it turned out, there were 27 minutes to go, because 7 minutes of injury time, there was a stoppage for Xhaka, wasn't there, where he got whacked in the head with the ball, and that seemed to affect him. And ultimately, he had to come off. But 27 minutes for West Ham at home to find a goal, I don't really remember them threatening, to be honest, which I don't know whether it says... as much about the way we controlled the game when we were winning or how poor they were. I think it's probably a little from column A, a little from column B, but I did like the way we played some just sensible possession football at 3-1 up. We didn't go chasing up the pitch looking for more goals. It just felt a bit common sense.
Yeah, we asserted a bit of control on the game. I mean, I think it would be remiss not to say that West Ham are not in a good way at the moment. And it's funny, I was looking at this fixture thinking, away to West Ham, London derby, this could be really tricky. And obviously when you go behind, those fears are compounded. But you've got to remember, this isn't Upton Park. I don't think that stadium helps them very much at all. They've lost 3 in a row at home now for the first time in about 4 years. So I think the paucity of quality in their team definitely helped us. But it was what we needed. And we looked so much more assured than we have done in literally months. So, yeah, I mean, a really, really good night. The right opponent at the right time. the right performance in that second half. And a massive relief.
Yeah, huge relief and hugely important because, look, we've said this before, the fixtures get more difficult now. Mm. We have some very difficult fixtures coming up.
True.
I think they're still going to be very difficult, but I'd rather we went into them off the back of... It's felt like a burden, a real weight on our shoulders, this run that we've been on. I don't think we can underestimate how much of a funk the team has been in. And, you know, it's very difficult sometimes to get yourself out of that kind of a run. And you just need a win. You just need a win by hook or by crook. It didn't really matter last night how we did it, to be honest. I wasn't hung up on performance. Things have got so bad that we've sort of gone from worrying about wins where we don't play that well to just wanting to win regardless of how we play. So things have been that dark. So for me, just to win is a massive positive, and one we can hopefully build on, take a little step forward.
Yeah, it could be a platform, couldn't it? There are things in Freddie's starting lineup that are possibly things he can build on. Chambers at centre half, Martinelli and Pepe on the wings, Aubameyang through the middle. You know, those are encouraging signs, and it to have a bit more confidence before, let's say, the visit of Manchester City on Sunday is invaluable. You know, that's still going to be a really tough game, but I think going into it like we were in that first half against West Ham, it could have been a particularly miserable afternoon. I think at least like this, it feels like we might have a fighting chance, a punching chance, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm just trying to think, is there anything else we can really take away from this? What have you got on your mind?
I felt very unfortunate for Kieran Tierney, isn't it, to pick up that injury. He was carrying a shoulder problem into the game, and I mean, it looked to me like it popped out. I don't know if that's been cleared or clarified since, but it didn't look good, did it?
Not yet, as far as I know. It did look like a dislocation. I think had it been dislocated, we probably would have heard that last night, because that's a fairly obvious thing. But you remember, was it Theo Walcott who for years had some shoulder problems which required surgery to really get on top of. I thought it was quite interesting because we were all wondering why it was that Kieran Tierney wasn't in the team. And then I think David Ornstein just dropped it into a little piece about Arsenal on The Athletic. And, you know, one of the reasons that Tierney has taken a bit more time to adapt is the fact that he's been struggling with this shoulder injury. And then all of a sudden, it looked fairly innocuous, didn't it, in the sense that there wasn't a great deal of contact between him and the other player. But whatever way he stretched his shoulder back. It's not good. It's not positive news. I also think that kind of makes the result last night even more positive.
Yeah.
Because he'd have worked on a game plan with Freddie or with Hector Bellerin at right back and Kieran Tierney at left back. And as you said earlier, I think Maitland-Niles for Bellerin is not necessarily like for like, but they're quite similar in terms of the way that they can play that position. But Kolasinac is a different kind of player to Tierney. It wasn't great for the goal, but he stepped up and made an assist to bring us back level. So, you know, on the basis that we lost our two first choice fullbacks, one before the game and one fairly quickly into the game, I think that's another little thing that the players should be happy about, their performance and their character in the wake of those little setbacks was admirable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the fact that we came back. I mean, Freddie, you know, at halftime against Brighton, he did provoke something of a response. I know it really wasn't the result that we wanted, but he got a response again in this match. And it does feel like even when the players start poorly, play without confidence, he is in some way able to motivate or affect them, at least, you know, after the halftime team talk. So that's, I think, a possible positive. I mean, we came from a halftime position where we were behind to win a Premier League match away from home for the first time in 8 years. So that's a big deal.
That was amazing. When they said that at halftime on Sky, I was like, fuck.
I know. That was the 5-3 Chelsea game where Robin van Persie scored a hat trick, I think.
Oh, John Terry slipped, of course.
Yes, yes.
That's,
I'd like to remember that
as
well.
Yeah, it is. What a beautiful morning this is. What a beautiful morning.
So, yeah, let's hope, I suppose, that the injury sustained to the squad, you know, Bellerin's hamstring, Tierney's shoulder, Xhaka's head, are a bit less concerning than they might have initially looked. But
yeah.
We'll find out.
Particularly as we're going into a very, very busy time of the year. So, yeah. Well, look, it was a step in the right direction. There are many more steps that we're going to have to take, obviously, and coming up on Sunday is Manchester City. So that's going to be a difficult one. Did we decide, I'm asking you this on air when probably should ask it off air, but did we decide what we're doing on Friday? I can't remember. Are we doing an extra on Friday?
I'm actually in Liège.
Right.
Several months ago, The Athletic said to me, we're looking at that end of group stage game, thinking it could be quite a biggie. Are you happy to go to Liège? And at the time I said, yes, I am happy to go to Liège. Now I'm slightly less happy to be going to Liège because I don't quite know what I'm getting into. But hey ho, at least it means I miss the election fallout in this country. So that might be a good thing.
Oh, God. Let's try and keep this keep this on an upbeat note as much as possible so we won't discuss any of that. Anything else you want to touch on in part one before we go to questions?
Just, we are staying up. I say we are staying up.
You know what? It's weird because we're looking over our shoulders. And now we're just 2 points behind fifth place. Fifth place, not where we want to be, obviously, but as the season goes on, you manage your expectations and you try and finish as high as you possibly can. That's all you can do. So 3 points are very, very welcome, very important. And at this time of the year, when there's so many games, there's such a lot can happen in the table in a few weeks. So,
yeah. For example, look at Chelsea. I mean, Chelsea looked like they were sort of disappearing over the horizon. Subsequently, they lost to this West Ham side at home. They lost to Duncan Ferguson's Everton side. And suddenly the table looks a bit more compressed. I mean, the gap between fourth place Chelsea and us is 7 points. I think, you know, we've all been looking at Leicester, who in fairness to them have absolutely pulled away. But fourth, Chelsea, doesn't feel quite as far, quite as insurmountable at this stage.
Yeah, I think we had a little bit of a tweet on that in the questions. It was about how tight it all is, but James Chesson, who's at James_Chesson, who says, can either of you recall a season where the table was this squashed together so far into it? Yesterday morning I was worried because we're 4 points above relegation, but now I'm looking at it thinking, ooh, we're only 2 points off fifth.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are 7 points off the Champions League places and 7 points off the bottom three.
That's bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of mad. It is very compressed. And that could work to our favour. It will work to the favour of whoever can put a run together.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, maybe that could be us. I've got a horrible feeling it might be Man United, but we'll see.
We'll see. Okay, we will take a break, I think, at this point. And come back, as we always do, with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/thearsblog, and also on the Arsblog Discord server, which you get access to if you're an Arsblog member on Patreon. Sign up today, patreon.com/arsblog. It's just a fiver a month. Just wanted to ask you very quickly before we get into questions and stuff, Did you watch much of Rafa Benitez last night on
Sky?
I
saw bits and pieces, mainly the post-match I saw with Rafa, yeah.
Yeah, he was interesting. I mean, he completely ruled out leaving China and coming back to the Premier League at this point. Seems to be quite happy where he is, which I guess is understandable given the fact he's being paid a monstrous amount of money. But he was interesting. I thought he was really, really good pundit and, you know, explained a lot of stuff tactically. I also thought it was very interesting where he talked about the impact one game can have. Now, I know we're this is me clutching at straws. I get it. But he talked about how he was basically one game away from being sacked by Valencia, and they were 2-0 down at halftime. I can't remember who they were against. 2-0 down. They came back to win 3-2 and then went on to win the league. And he said that one game had such a huge effect on, you know, his future at the club and the club itself. And, you know, we're looking at Freddie and we're wondering, you know, can he take us on? Can he take us forward? You know, what is the impact going to be of beating West Ham, particularly when you look at the difficulty of the fixtures? But there are so many intangibles in football, aren't there, that you can't quite put your finger on things with any certainty and say, well, because of this, this is going to happen, or because this happened, that's going to happen. But it would be great if this one game and this one win really did set us on the right trajectory again.
Of course, it'd be amazing. I mean, we had a question kind of on this from Takar, who's at Takar75 on Twitter. And they said, are Arsenal fans taking this win against the subpar West Ham side too far? I think we're still in a mid-table battle that can easily turn into a relegation battle. Or is this the turning point of our season? I guess we will only know that in the fullness of time.
Yeah. Look, I can't say. And if you were to ask me, when you look at the fixtures that we've got coming up, which I'm just going to do, but our next game in the Premier League is against Manchester City, who are going through a difficult time of their own, obviously. But, you know, they have such quality and such such a great manager and coaching staff there that it doesn't feel like something that will last too long. And if they're determined to get back on track and try and keep pace with Liverpool, you know, they're defending their title as well. You know, you look at that game and you worry.
Oh, yeah.
I worry about that game in a big way. You know, as happy as I am about winning last night, you know, I'm not blind to the fact that Manchester City are by far a better team than we are, and even if they're going through a difficult period, probably have more resources and more resolve and more experience going into that particular game. Then you've got Everton away, then Bournemouth away. And like, in fairness, I think both of those we should be looking at games as winnable. Again, maybe that's being overly optimistic to away games, but you know, if we can do it against West Ham, Everton are similarly struggling, Bournemouth are struggling as well. And then you got a home game against Chelsea, home game against Manchester United. So look, it's going to be a very difficult festive period, and the injuries might well play a part, but I can't make any predictions one way or the other. I just hope that from last night there is the embers of something which might ignite again, that these players realise that they're not quite as bad as things have suggested over the last little while. You know, this is a team that finished fifth last season, a point off the top four. It's a team that, you know, got to a European final. I know there have been changes, and I know there have been some additions and subtractions to the squad and what have you. But, as critical as we've been, we've always felt that the players are capable of better. So hopefully that's what we see. You know.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, we saw that confidence flowing back into them, I think, as they took control of the game yesterday. But I am worried about City. I mean, they tend to respond pretty well to defeats. It was earlier this season, wasn't it, when they responded to losing to Norwich by beating Watford 8-0. But we'll be in much better shape than we would otherwise have been.
Yeah.
And I can't believe you're overlooking the big match in Liège, Andrew. Come on, that is the one.
I'm not overlooking it. I've just got a question about it, which I'm saving. I'm trying to segue nicely into that one. I suppose I might as well do it now then.
Let's do it then.
And we'll come back. And it comes from Josh, who's at Josh Robinson 87, who says, what team would you pick for Thursday night? Do we change the team or do we go with the lineup from last night to breed more confidence in them?
Yeah, I was thinking about this last night and I sort of got caught slightly in two minds, because I think to have a bit of positive momentum and to have a win under our belt, there is a temptation to try and keep that going. I think realistically, given what we've got coming up in terms of the fixture congestion, we probably have to make changes. And I suppose the one good thing is by dropping someone like David Luiz or Lacazette, you give yourself fresh options in Europe. So I think for the most part, we should be able to put out a relatively strong looking side while heavily mixing it up. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think we do have to mix it up. Pepe came off last night. He was absolutely knackered, wasn't
yes.
he? And I think what Pepe did last night demands a start in the next Premier League game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think the players will also look at these games differently. You know, it's different. A game against Standard Liège, with all due respect to our Belgian chums, is not quite as high profile or exciting or challenging as a game against Manchester City at home at the Emirates, right? That's the one that they'll all want to play in, not the Europa League game. But those that do have got a job to do. I think he does have to mix it up a bit. I think he's going to play. I would not be surprised to see a relatively young team play against Liège. I think we could see, I mean, Martinelli complicates it now, doesn't he? Because he's another one who's sort of played his way into contention for the Premier League. And I, you know, under normal circumstances, he would play in the Europa League. But I think we could see Lacazette up front, for example, with Saka and Nelson
mm-hmm.
on the wings.
Joe Willock, you'd think, would play.
Joe Willock. I think we'll see Guendouzi in the Europa League team. Mm-hmm. At the back, I think it's going to be Luiz and Mustafi.
I think fullback's interesting, isn't it? We had a question on Facebook from, I think it's Keevin. Keevin? I'm going to go for. It's a very Irish name.
Queevin.
Queevin, I was close. And I'm not going to attempt the surname, but how many Queevins can there be listening? So Queevin says, with Tierney getting injured and Kolasinac playing well when he came on, do you think Standard Liège is a good time to promote somebody from the under-23s, e.g. Medley, into the squad for the purposes of depth at left-back?
Well, I don't think Medley's a left-back anyway, is he? He definitely isn't a left-back.
He's not. He can do it, but it's not his best position.
No, it is a complicated one. The fullbacks are definitely a problem, because if Bellerin is injured, maybe he'll be okay for Sunday. You could play Maitland-Niles again at right back.
Could you play, I mean, alternatively, maybe Mustafi at right back just for the body and give one of the other centre-halves another game? Centre-halves tend to withstand, you know, minutes better than some other positions.
Maybe so. Or I don't know what the state of play with Mavropanos is, whether he could come in
played
and play
for the under-23s the other day.
Right, so maybe he could come in. I don't know who there is at youth level who might be able to make the step up in the fullback positions.
Well, if anyone will know, it might be Freddie, having been under 23 manager last season.
That is a very good point.
He will have some knowledge. I mean, Dominic Thompson, who played a bit at left back from last year, has left on a permanent deal to Brentford.
Yeah.
Cohen Bramall obviously left in the summer as well. So I am trying to think, who is the guy who plays left back? Let me have a look. There are a couple who they're not. It's not an area where I think we're especially well off.
No.
Let's put it like that.
There's a young lad we got from Barcelona, but I don't think he's quite there with the under-23s yet. No. Is it Joel Lopez is his name?
Correct. Yeah, he's not quite there. I'm having a look. I think maybe Tajali Bola has been playing there.
Right.
For the under-23s. So maybe, I mean, someone will get a game that they wouldn't otherwise be expected to get. I don't think we can ask that of Kolasinac, three games in a week, especially given what he's likely to face against Man City, which is a hell of a test.
Yeah, and we're assuming that Tierney is not going to be available for this weekend.
I mean, I'm kind of assuming he might be out for this Christmas period. I mean,
I think it could be a lengthy one, yeah.
Yeah.
So, look, yeah, some decisions to make there for Freddie, but, you know, if we're realistic, he may just have to throw in a couple of kids or just shuffle the senior players around and ask them to do jobs that they have to do because we just don't have anybody else. So
and in Lacazette, Louise, Guendouzi, there is a bit of a spine to hang that team on. You know, it's not like we're just throwing kids to the lions there. And if we could get a positive result, even a draw, just something to kind of keep that momentum bubbling away, I do think that would be a really good thing.
Well, yeah, okay.
Let's have a question, shall we?
Sure.
Right. Okay. Lisa, who's at Gunner Attic, says, what do we make of Freddie dropping Guendouzi for two games straight? Is he resting him or is this tactics?
I think it's tactics. I think Xhaka had a pretty poor game. There was one moment in the second half where he played one of those Xhaka passes. And, you know, we talked about his role in the goal, and there was another moment in the second half where he went up for a header and it was all very half-hearted. Mm-hmm. You know, he's such a weird guy, Xhaka. It's so fucking strange because, you know, he celebrated the goals really strongly. And there were moments where I thought in that first half, and in the second half in particular, I remember a moment where we had a throw midway in our own half. I think Maitland-Niles was taking. I was looking around at the players and nobody was moving. There was no movement, nobody really coming to get the ball. And Xhaka was that guy. You know, and it's sort of this weird dichotomy of him being committed and then not committed. I find it hard to get a read on where his head is. You know, it's difficult. But I do think Freddie seems to like Torreira and Xhaka together. And I thought actually Torreira last night was. That was his best game for a while. Again, I know we're coming at things from a low bar and everything else, but I did think there was promise in the way that Torreira played, in the way that he performed positionally. I thought he was disciplined. And yeah, I do think it is maybe just Freddie taking Guendouzi out of the firing line. He was sort of like a default pick, wasn't he, for for Unai Emery. Emery had a lot of faith in him, and there were times maybe where you thought, okay, this guy, this kid, he's good, but he's 20 and he needs perhaps to just sit down, you know, a game or two and not feel like his place in the team is assured. And perhaps that's what Freddie is doing, maybe.
I think so. And I think when you look at Freddie's squad selections, I think you see that, especially with the younger players, he's not afraid to bring them in for a game, take them out for a game. I mean, Bukayo Saka is a good example. You know, he came on at Norwich, then I don't think he made the squad for the Brighton match. Mm. Then Joe Willock started Freddie's first two games, wasn't in the squad last night. I think if he feels like he needs to sit somebody down or give them a break, especially the younger players, he will do that. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Guendouzi looked tidy enough when he came on, and he'll be chomping at the bit, I think, for the Liège match. You know, he'll be desperate to play against Man City. So a bit of competition for his place is no bad thing. And I think going from an automatic pick to someone who's got to earn that spot will probably benefit him and us in the long term.
Mm. Right, we'll move on to questions about, you know, what might come next, I think.
Yeah.
And we do have a few of those. But here's one from Jonathan Houseman, who's at Johnny Houseman on Twitter. Would the worst thing to be to appoint a former player without managerial experience as opposed to a Premier League-ready appointment? Is an Arteta or Vieira appointment just there to appease the fans as opposed to an actual plan of desired style and progress?
That's an interesting question. I have to say, in both those instances, I don't think it's just about appeasing the fans. I think there are things about both guys as coaches that would appeal to Arsenal. With Arteta, it's obviously his association with Guardiola and the kind of football that Manchester City are playing. With Vieira, I think while he has had a bit of a tricky time at Nice, certainly when he was in America, his team were well regarded for the type of football he sought to play. And it does seem to tally with a lot of, if you hear him talk about football, it tallies with what we might identify as a desirable form of football for Arsenal to play. So
yeah.
I think they do have attributes that go beyond that. I mean, it's a tricky one. I mean, it does feel a bit like you're potentially appointing someone who the fans are going to give more time, but then I think that is necessary. I mean, when we look at where we are, and I know it's only 7 points to the top four, but I do think we are at the start of a process now that might take more than a season, might take more than two seasons, you know, to get to where we want to be. I think we might have to invest in a project. And if the club could sort of convince the fans that there was a project happening, I think it would kind of buy the incoming manager, the executives and the players a bit more time as we see this come together. And I kind of think they're just more likely to do that with a manager who is A bit younger and B maybe someone they already have a bit of positive affection for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because, you know, it tallies with what we were talking about with, you know, with Emery when he was still in charge.
Yeah.
You know, we said, look, if we could see what was going on here, if we could see the green shoots, if we could see the foundations of something being built as he worked his tactics around it, you know, you could get on board with that a lot easier. You know, it always felt a bit slapdash, or, you know, we're moving from one thing to the next thing. And that's the way I think things have gone a little bit with this, with our football executive committee, that we don't quite know what the plan is. You know, they've talked about, you know, the Arsenal way and Arsenal DNA and Arsenal football and all that kind of stuff. But what is that? What is that exactly? Or what do they want it to be? You know, do they want it to be what it was under Arsene Wenger, for example, in the first 10 years of Wenger's reign? Is that what they aspire for Arsenal to be? To be tough, strong, quick, play great attacking football? If that's what it is, I think we can all get on board with that. But say it and then go out and build that kind of a squad, which we know is going to take some time. But if we have that clarity of vision and if we can see that that's what they're trying to do, then I think it does buy time for both the people making the decisions and the person that ultimately they put in the job.
Yeah, I mean, if Arsenal appoint Mikel Arteta or Patrick Vieira, one of whom has never really managed a senior game, I think we have to accept that they're not going to walk in on day one and be the finished article. If they're appointed, we're appointing a manager who it's like signing a young player. They're going to improve. They're going to develop as they go. And personally speaking, I'm sort of okay with that. I'm kind of ready to be like, well, look, we sort of tried the quick fix way of buying players who were 30 and appointing a manager who had a speciality in the Europa League and all those things, and it didn't really work out. I think if you could sell me on a vision of, well, this is a 3 to 5 year plan with a coach who's going to improve, with a group of young players who are going to improve, but we're hopefully all pulling in the same direction, I'm ready for that. I would be all right with it. Whether that patience is something everybody shares, I don't know.
Nobody can be under any illusions now that a manager is going to come in and just make it better straight away. Yeah. Surely. You know, we've gone from a situation, James, where, you know, we'd talk on this podcast or previous podcasts and say Arsenal are 2 or 3 players away from being the team that we all want them to be. Mm. That's not the case anymore. We're 2 or 3 transfer windows, at least.
Yeah. At least two or three years.
Yeah, you know, from being the team that we want Arsenal to be. So I do think there is a need to be realistic about how much can be achieved, whether it's Mikel Arteta, Patrick Vieira, or anybody else. I think that's something we, as fans, have got to come to terms with. And I know it's really hard to suggest that to people or to expect in this sort of world of short-term opinion that seems to be so prevalent, whether it's football or anything else, that people have a measure of patience and give something time.
Yeah, I mean, to look at Chelsea by way of example, I don't think Chelsea fans think Frank Lampard is currently the best coach or manager in the Premier League. But I do think that because he's Frank Lampard and because there's clearly a project at play, they are prepared to give him time and think, well, he might get better. You know, he will learn. He will improve on the job. And I kind of think a similar thing could happen at Arsenal because we have got a group of exciting young players. You know, that academy batch you've come through this summer, other young players like, you know, Torreira, Tierney. Pepe. You know, I do think there is an exciting group to work with there. And I just think, my hunch is that if you appoint someone like Allegri, as fantastic as their track record is, that almost might contribute to the idea that, OK, we're going to turn around and suddenly be competing for the title in the immediate future. I think that there needs to be almost an admission that that's not on the table and say, look, what I'd love is, you know, the Cronkies always saying, well, our ambition is to compete for the Premier League and the Champions League. They love saying stuff like that. It'd be great if they were like, we accept that currently we are not in a position to do those things, but this is the project we're going to undertake to get there.
Yeah.
And I really think that given what's happened with Emery, I think there might be more appetite for that now and people might be willing to give it sort of the time and the patience it will need.
Okay. Do you think in that context then people will be willing to give the Football Executive Committee the time to make the right appointment, or if, you know, we lose to City and then, you know, we don't play well against Everton, that pressure on them to make a decision about who's going to take the job is going to grow?
Yeah, I mean, I had a question sort of like this from the Discord from Emmanuel Lane. And Emmanuel said, I'm worried that Arsenal might jump too quickly in deciding who should be the next coach. Typically, their decision-making seems to be rushed and quite often leads to disaster. Do you think we need to take a time out from making a decision, leaving Freddie operate as the caretaker until the end of the season? I mean, the West Ham result buys them a bit more time, doesn't it? Had they lost last night, I think there would have been a need almost to just stop the bleeding and make a change, you know, to try and elicit some sort of response from this group of players. I think as it is, they've got a little bit more time, although there is some chat around. I think Guillaume Balague tweeted yesterday saying he expects Arsenal to make an appointment this week.
Yeah, there's another one on the Discord from Marijan10, who says, goodly fucking morning, gents. Goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning.
Goodly morning. What do you make of the Carlo Ancelotti rumours coming from Di Marzio? He is quitting after their Champions League game against Genk. He's in charge at Napoli, for those who don't know, and immediately flying to London to take over Arsenal. Also, being Croatian, I hope we dodge the Niko Kovac bullet.
Yes, Kovac, I think, is throwing his own hat into the ring from what I can see. The Ancelotti situation is weird. I saw a story this morning that Napoli have already agreed terms with Gattuso as his as his
sometimes maybe good, sometimes maybe shit.
Exactly. Ancelotti, I mean, yeah, it's an option. I think it's one of the less exciting ones for me personally.
Safe though, perhaps a safe
perhaps, yeah.
Safe pair of hands.
Very good at, you know, players like him, and he generally has happy squads, and happy squads, as Freddie has said in the last 2 weeks, play good football.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you ask me now, would I rather have an Arteta or a Vieira? That's definitely more the side that I'd be on.
Yeah, sure, but as we said earlier, that Arteta-Vieira thing has to come in tandem with the plan or the project or the strategy, yeah, that's true. Very clear. So do you think in the space of the last few weeks, you know, let's not forget that it was only a couple of weeks ago when Raul and the rest of them were firmly behind Unai Emery and dismissing criticism of him from fans and from the media as noise and external pressures and things like that. Do you think those people who are so prepared to stay with Emery have, in this short space of time, put in place the kind of plan that would allow a manager like a Vieira or an Arteta or somebody younger, somebody forward-thinking, to come in and implement their vision?
I'm not sure. The only thing I would say is that for all their faith in Emery, in the summer they really did foreground the academy and they did sell players to create opportunities for those academy players within our squad. So while their faith in the coach was ultimately misplaced, I do think that there was a commitment to rejuvenating this squad and sort of leaning into the strength of our academy.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just about identifying the right coach to deal with that and to help those players develop. I mean, again, Freddie's name will be circulated, I'm sure, because he knows those players better than anybody.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, I love the idea of young players coming through our academy, but when you talk about what we did in the summer, and clearly we did sell players and make room in the squad for young players to come through, and you could point to that as being a very smart long-term thing to do because you're giving these players time to develop and that kind of stuff, right? Mm. But there was something that Vinay said in those interviews where it was, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but it's a cost-effective way for Arsenal to build a squad. So you get rid of some high earners, you bring in some young kids on relatively low wages with the hope that many of them will make it, but with the knowledge that most of them won't. And what you're doing is you're replenishing your squad and you're making those young players more valuable for when you sell them. So that's sort of in the back of my mind when you talk about that.
Yeah.
But in relation just to an appointment and when it might happen, I think there was something quite interesting in what Freddie said after the game. Now, maybe he's been told to say this, I don't quite know, but he said, I've been told, I've spoken to Edu, and I'm just taking it on a game-by-game basis. So maybe he has to say that, but it doesn't sound like there's anything from those people to Freddie to say, look, you're in charge for the foreseeable future because we're going to take our time to make the right appointment. That's just maybe reading between the lines a little bit, but
I mean, clearly there are conversations going on, I think. And if they can, I think if they can make the appointment they want now, I think they will. I mean, it's, you know, we talk about a rush, a worry that they might rush it, but how long has it been since Emery was sacked? It's been 2.5 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, and 3 games in that time. Managers certainly get appointed quicker than that in a lot of situations. I mean, Spurs is a very particular example, but they appointed a manager the next morning. So there has been time and a process undertaken. I think we just obviously don't know the ins and outs of it. But what's your gut tell you? Do you think we're going to have a new manager before Christmas, or do you think Freddie's going to lead us through this period?
My gut tells me they're going to appoint somebody relatively soon. I think. I don't know who it's going to be. Obviously, nobody does. I notice David Ornstein is sort of leaning fairly heavily towards the Mikel Arteta thing again.
Yeah, yeah.
Some suggestions that it won't happen before the Man City game for very obvious reasons. But in the wake of that Man City game, he could become the new guy. So,
what a weird week that would be for Mikel Arteta, because it's Arsenal-Man City on the Sunday, and then the next game that
Arsenal-Everton
is Everton-Arsenal.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah, look, football is really weird the way it throws up little quirky things like that. But, yeah, I suspect that given what happened the last time with Arteta and the way that ultimately he didn't get the job, which I know hurt him because of how far down the road it was.
I'm sure.
And because of how last minute the Emery thing was, despite what they say, it was the last ditch appointment. I think if we're going to go down the Arteta road again, it can't be to do the same thing to him, because then you burn that bridge completely, don't you?
You're right. You're right.
So if we are going to, I don't mean lead him on, but if we are going to go down that road with him based on what's happened in the past, you would think he would want some assurances that, look, you're not going to fuck me at the last minute again. Do you remember, like, it could be a common theme, actually. Do you remember when we signed Arteta and he was on his way to London and we phoned him, or something happened where it was something to do with the length of contract? I can't remember exactly, but basically it meant that he would be taking a pay cut from Everton to come and join Arsenal. And the following season, the senior players, given the influence that he had when he came in at that difficult period, himself and Mertesacker in particular, a delegation of the senior players went to Arsene Wenger to suggest that it was unfair that this wage inequity happened. But he was prepared to still join at that point, even though last minute we tried to fuck him. And then with the manager thing 18 months ago, we definitely fucked him. So how prepared is Mikel Arteta to get fucked by Arsenal again? That's a question.
Well, yeah, and one wonders almost if they, you know, if they are meeting other candidates or interviewing other candidates. One suspects he might almost be inclined to say, well, you've interviewed me once. Do you know what I mean? You know what I think. Come to me when you've got an offer. And
well, I don't think he's in a position really to be like that, to be honest. I don't think he is, because he's never managed a game. He's obviously a very promising coach, and look, yeah, there are people who are talking about him taking over from Pep at Manchester City. You know, Manchester City's not a club being run by idiots. So if that's something they're prepared to do, there's clearly potential there in his talent as a coach and what have you. But, you know, I don't think he's in a position to just say, look, you know what I'm about, give me the job. I think he's got to, you know, explain to them what more he has learned in the 18 months at Man City, and what it is that he thinks he could do with Arsenal in the state that it's in right now to bring us back to where we want to be. So I think he's got some work to do in convincing people that he's the right man for the job.
Well, yes, and also, I suppose, to assuage some of the concerns. I mean, one of the issues with him last time was he didn't have a backroom staff. Now, maybe the presence of Freddie, for example, is something that, you know, helps in that regard. They'd want to keep him on, I think, certainly. But, you know, who else would his backroom staff be? Things like that can close the gap that he didn't close last time. I mean, my gut on the manager is that this week, with three match days in the space of 7 days, I just don't see Arsenal announcing or doing anything in that period. But
no.
Once the Man City game is out the way, you've got a full week then before Everton on the Saturday. And that does feel like it might be the time, potentially, where they could put something in place. So, my eyes are firmly on next week for that.
Mm. Is it my question? I think it is.
It
could well be. This one comes from Harry, who is at Harry_Herneman, who says, has your opinion of Emery changed slightly since hearing the reports from David Ornstein about his preferential signings? And do you feel for him knowing he was fully aware of the good evening jokes? There was another one on Twitter that I saw, but I can't find it now. Apologies. Happy Wenger, who's at FM_Jai_Nan. In the light of Ornstein's article on Emery not being overly impressed by the mockery of his command of English, where should we fans draw the line? Obviously, with your good evening sketches and all, you probably have meant it to be more of an endearment of sorts. So let's deal with the signings thing first, where it was revealed he wanted Zaha, he wanted Harry Maguire, and he wanted the dude from Atletico Madrid, the defensive
Thomas
midfielder,
Partey.
So, give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I, for one, am shocked that Arsenal did not give Unai Emery those £200 million worth of players. he also would have liked Messi. And he didn't come. I mean, I'm sure that he did want those players because I know David's sourcing is always impeccable. But wanting them and then being realistic is a very different thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There was no chance. You know, if you're pushing for Zaha, who might have cost more than
Pepe,
how do you then expect Arsenal to pay 80 odd million pounds for Harry Maguire? Mm. I saw a brilliant tweet about Harry Maguire during the week. I hope I liked it. Where are my likes? I have to look it up. So you can't expect Arsenal to pay 80 million for Harry Maguire, another 50 odd million for Partey. That's just not realistic in any way, is it?
No, I think maybe a more fair question is, would either of those players have been a more sensible use of the money Arsenal paid for Pepe? I think that's a debate, you know, that you could have. But I don't think it was ever realistic to land those three. Does it change my opinion of Emery? Not really. I mean, I do think that Emery not really being party to the transfer decisions at the club did hinder him. I will say that. I think he lost players that he would have picked and that probably would have helped him. I'm thinking people like Monreal, Iwobi, Mkhitaryan. But those decisions were made in the best interest of the club. And I think that for the most part, we thought they were the right kind of call. So as for the good evening thing, I mean, yes, of course, that is unpleasant that he knew that that was sort of a meme. And I admire him for sticking with it and never budging from it in the light of that.
Yeah, look, here's the thing. If Arsenal had won a lot of games and played well and been successful and been where we wanted them to be, good evening would have been like this quirky little phrase that everyone would have found kind of endearing.
As it was, I think, in the first half of last season.
Yeah, of course it was. You know, it was just one of those funny little quirks of language. It's kind of like, you know, Wenger had loads of them and we just sort of went with them because, that's the way that he talked. Mm-hmm. You know, a little bit handbrake and
exactly.
all of that kind of stuff, you know, look. So, you know, it was all really dependent on results. There are always some people who will take things a bit too far, I guess. But, you know, it's just the context in which those good evenings were delivered. It became what it was.
Yeah. Absolutely. And interesting to see him link with the Everton job.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if he'll go for it, but it'll be fascinating to see him back in English football quite so quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's Spain feels more likely a destination.
Sure.
But there you go.
For sure.
Let's have a look. I had a couple more questions. I enjoyed this one from Neil Siglechner on the Discord. And Neil said, is this victory down to the Arsenal players having only bland and flavourless dinners waiting for them at home? Yes, Neil, it is. It's entirely down to that. And I could tell from the way they played, the way they celebrated. They celebrated like people who were like, we've got to enjoy this moment because our dinners are going to be so horrible.
Maybe they were promised really nice pies if they won a game.
Maybe.
Until such time as you guys win a game of football, you will be served flavorless, gritty gruel for every single meal. But if you would like a delicious shepherd's pie smothered with gravy, you win. And we will deliver to you all the delights of the chef's kitchen.
Very possibly. Very possibly. What about this one from Roy Diaz, who says, "It looked like Per was involved in the coaching setup today. I missed the announcement that he's interim assistant manager.
Interim.
Thoughts on his future in first team coaching. Do you think there's any chance Per gets sidetracked or, you know, drawn into the coaching world?"
I don't know. I mean, he's a really smart guy, Mertesacker, and I think that's a really important thing if you're a manager. I had my brother texted me last night about what did he say exactly here? I'm just giving you this in the context of really smart people being managers.
Right.
He said Sherwood is a fucking moron. And I said, we don't have him on TV. He was obviously watching on a stream. I said, what's he saying? He said, just nonsensical shite. Sentences are hard. So I just wanted to get that in there while we were talking about
it. It's always good to squeeze that in. I have asked Mertesacker about this, and he was quite insistent a few months ago that he didn't want to get into coaching and that...
Yeah.
He saw his future as a technical director. I do think it's an intriguing one, though, because I think if you're a footballer, someone whose life has been out on the training pitch, there must be a certain thrill, you know, to being back out there with the players, sat on the bench, part of that group, part of that camaraderie. I'd be amazed if it doesn't make him have, you know, a little second thought.
Maybe. I think, you know, He obviously cares a great deal for the club. You can tell that in the way that he talks about the job that he's doing as academy manager. And he was very proud, you know, as a captain of the club and to win trophies with Arsenal, et cetera, et cetera. So I think he is sort of stepping into the breach, you know, to give Freddie a hand at what is a difficult period. And, you know, if Freddie is not the guy for even the short to medium term, there's no point in him bringing in staff or appointing staff from outside. Is there for one game or two games or sort of however many games it might be? It might be four or five games in the end, you know. So what do we have to work with at the club? But you've got a guy who knows the young players. You've got a guy who knows the club itself. You know, he's there, he's in situ. So I think that's probably as far as it's going to go with Per. But, you know, it's a good looking bench. You know, you look at Frenny on the bench, you look at Mertesacker there beside him, you know, you can connect with that. You can connect with that, which brings me to, I think, what will make the final question.
Go on.
It comes from Noonan, who's at Noonan Nation. And he says, do you think the fan-manager relationship is as important as we think it is?
What a good question. Because something we asked during Emery's tenure is, can you think of managers who sort of succeeded in spite of the fans at times? And in fact, in spite of their relationship with the fans. And it is a difficult one to...
I think we used Rafa, didn't we, at Chelsea? Rafa Benitez at Chelsea as the only example we could really think of. And even that was short-term.
Yes, I think in a short-term situation it's easier. I think it's pretty integral. I mean, as the role of captain diminishes, particularly at Arsenal, and becomes less and less of a kind of totem pole for the club, I think the role of manager becomes, or head coach as it may be, all the more important, because that person is simultaneously kind of spokesperson, cheerleader, you know, decision maker. I think, and given the way fans are so interested in the intricacies now of training and tactics and those elements, I think there is so much focus on that individual that I think it actually probably is incredibly important. Yeah, I sort of stand by that. What about you?
Yeah, it's crucial. Crucial. Mm. You know, football management is a really, really difficult job. You know, we can criticize and we all have our opinions on what a manager should do and everything else, but we should be under no illusions as well that it is an extremely difficult job, not least because you've got to manage relationships with fans. You've got to manage relationships with, you know, fans in the stadium and fans not in the stadium. You have to kind of control those two relationships. You also have to manage club politics. You have to manage players, players being good, players being bad. You've got to manage the media. Like, there's no hiding place anymore for a manager. You know, you're on 24/7, basically.
Yeah.
So I do think it's a really, really tough job. But I think the connection between fans and a manager is huge. For the manager, for the fans, for the club, for the atmosphere that it generates, for the environment that it creates for the players. It's absolutely vital. And it's why communication is a big, big part of it. And I think that was, as hard as he tried, one of Emery's, you know, big failings, an inability to communicate properly what he wanted from the team or from his job. And it was only towards the dying days where he started talking about connecting with the fans, which showed you how important it was for him. He understood, but it wasn't something that he seemed to put a great deal of effort into, I guess, because he would have looked and said, well, if we do it on the pitch, then that will kind of take care of itself. But in the absence of that, you have to be able to connect with fans. So I think it's really, really a massive part of the job for a manager and for our experience as fans as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, we talked about that idea of trust a lot this season. And I think having a manager and a figurehead who the fans trust is what gives a club room and time to grow. And that is what we desperately need right now.
Okay, well, look, on that note, we're going to leave it there. Thank you for being here. Hopefully you've enjoyed what has been, I think, a much more upbeat and positive podcast than the ones we've had in recent weeks and months.
Yeah.
But that's not our fault. But look, hope you enjoyed the show as ever. Please give us a rating review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Tell a friend, share the podcast around. James, you enjoy your trip to Belgium.
I will.
On Thursday?
Thursday.
Yeah.
The big one.
The big one. Standard Liège versus Arsenal. We will cover that on the Arscast on Friday morning. So until then, take it easy, folks. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.